Welcome to Circular Firing Squad. I'm Marty Gentius, a counseling faculty at Kent State University and host for Circular Firing Squad. We're a little short-shifted tonight because we're missing the mothers and the mother lovers and you can interpret that any way you want. All right, you've got a dirty, dirty mind. So we've got a shorter cast of folks. Let's find out who's with us tonight.
Hey, folks. Name is Mitch Conrad. Clinical mental health counseling graduate student at Cleveland State University.
Hi, everyone. Elliot Ingersoll, professor of counseling at Cleveland State University and host of Apply Topically.
We've got a different kind of episode tonight because it's just the three of us guys together. But what we're going to do is each do two questions, and we'll move through these pretty quickly because you're only going to get three responses on each of the questions. And we'll see how it goes in terms of a show. I think we have some weird questions for you today. And let's start out with Mitch.
Yeah, so my weird question is, what message was internalized for you that was challenging to address?
First thing that popped into my brain mind was the masculinity stuff. Just the, you know, oh, boys don't cry, all of that stuff. And it's a whole script. I just remember, I don't know. I had some very good friends, and I know a few didn't resonate with it because we talked about it. That was very helpful. Just, I think a lot of people, maybe they resonated with it, so that's fine for them. But, you know, a lot of that stuff sure didn't work for me. And that was just in stages, you know, figuring out what it means for me being male as whoever, you know, father, friend. It's kind of a work in progress, I'd say.
I had a rather quiet father, and he said a few things. And one of the things he said out of frustration really sucked into me. And he said, "You'll always hate a part of your job." Now, I think he was not happy at work, particularly in the later years of his employment, because he was real happy to retire when he could retire. And I think some of that expression, that fatherly wisdom that was attempted to be passed on to me by him, was coming from his own job experience. You'll always hate a part of your job. And that was a struggle for me because there are parts of my job I find frustrating, but I don't think I hate them. But I always was waiting for that other shoe to drop, and it never seemed to drop for me. Sure, you know, I have the same complaints about any of the jobs that I've been in, not the same complaints, but little complaints about how any job that I've been in, how it could be better and different. But generally, I've enjoyed all my work. So that was really challenging for me to kind of pull that out of my psyche.
Yeah, thank you both for your answers. I am going to also go with the answer that that Dr. I gave, which was the idea of like boys don't cry. And the way that I internalized that, which was men, it is not okay or it is not acceptable for men to show emotions, or perhaps more specifically, that it is acceptable for men to show specific emotions, perhaps something like anger, but unacceptable to show other emotions, perhaps like sadness something, you know, love, or, you know, more of the, you know, some of the other intense emotions that we have. And that was something that was internalized for me, not just through my own father, but also society, right? Growing up in school, this was sort of, I think there was clearly some messaging there. There was clearly some messaging in society. And I think that I bought it for a really long time. Probably until I was in my 20s, really, that I tried to figure out like, well, what did that actually mean for me, you know, and sort of like the idea of reattributing the meaning of those messages, right, and sort of discarding, you know, what they, you know, how they impacted me, you know.
You know, we're an all Y chromosome. From what I can tell, an all Y chromosome panel tonight. It would be interesting to see what the women on our panel would have to say,
right,
in terms of that question, what message was internalized for you.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking too, like, now that I'm starting to get all these joint replacements and, you know, injections for arthritis, I'm like, yeah, wow, I'm still paying the price for all those stupid fights and, you know, all that stuff that I thought, well, yes, it's important, but Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you're following that script, make sure you have health insurance in your later years. Okay. My question, if your program were an amusement park ride, what would the ride be?
I had a hard time coming up with an amusement park ride. I didn't go to a lot of amusement parks. And now that I'm older, going on some moving object that's going to change direction really quickly just does not sound like a lot of fun. So I came up with BOGO, buy one, get one free, because right now we're hiring new people that aren't in yet. We've lost some faculty through retirements and death. And because of that, a lot of the senior faculty are doubling up on roles. So it feels like it's buy one senior faculty, get one free. So that would be whatever kind of ride that would be. That would be the name of the amusement ride that I'm on right now.
Yeah, I'm going to stick in Ohio with this one and think about some Cedar Point rides. I was trying to figure out which roller coaster our program is. If someone out there is familiar with Cedar Point, right? It's one of the amusement parks with one of the most total amount of roller coasters in the world. I think it's got, you know, almost 20. There's an old one built in maybe 1998 or 1988 called the Magnum XL. My mom insists that it ruined her back and neck for life. Didn't want to go with that one for our program. That one doesn't feel right. Some of the other ones, Cedar Creek Mine Ride, which is sort of built over a swamp. I don't know how they built this over a swamp, but it seems completely unsafe and unfriendly. And I am convinced that if I did go on that ride, I would probably not make it off the ride, at least not dry. But didn't want to go with that one for our program either. So I went with the Millennium Force because it feels like an all-around fantastic ride. It's still a roller coaster that was, you know, it's been around for a while. There's certainly some bumps on it, like I'm sure every student is experiencing inside of our program with practicum and internship and taking classes and everything. But I really like this ride. I've always liked Millennium Force. I've always liked the Raptor. I've tried the new one, Steel Vengeance, which is a little too bumpy for me. Also really love the Maverick, but I for our program, I'd go with the Millennium Force.
Good call. I did what you did, Mitch. I was thinking of Cedar Point, and I was thinking about our mix of experiential and kind of more academic lecturing types of activities in the program and the people involved. And I was thinking of the log ride. There's probably a name for it that I don't know, but it's one of the first ones you see at Cedar Point. It's got to be a ride where you get wet, and that's the whole experiential piece, right? So yeah, I was thinking like it's the log ride, and you got to get closer to people because the way you have to sit in that thing, you know, it's kind of a toboggan style, and maybe you have to get closer than you really want to or are comfortable. And I thought, yeah, that's about right. But it's overall fun. That was the bottom line for me. You know, you get wet, but no harm done. Thanks for those answers.
So I have the next question, and it is, we're all of us are into final exams and final week and grading and trying to put to bed the semester. And the question is, how do you, or in Mitch's case, how would you deal with requests for extensions on assignments?
Yeah, you know, these are always the more fascinating questions to me. I mean, I really like a lot of questions, but these are really fascinating to me because I have never had to do this. I have never had to deal with a request or an extension on an assignment. My hope is to start teaching after I graduate, and I imagine that I will be immediately experiencing a request or an extension for an assignment. And so I have done some reflection on this. What does it look like, you know, if someone has, you know, a legitimate circumstance, something like the death of, you know, a death of a family member or, you know, a crisis going on in their life that was unavoidable and unexpected, clearly, right? I think that my goal here is to encourage students as much as possible that they can submit assignments early. And so that's one way that I would like to organize my classes, is that there is room for students to submit assignments early. All the content isn't necessarily, one doesn't need to experience all the content before, doing the assignment. And so one of my professors in the program does something that I really like, which is accept assignments early and provide a little bit of feedback you know, if you get them in time, I think it's a week before the due date. Now, there's no grade that you would receive with that feedback. It might be 2 weeks before the due date. I'm not 100% sure. But the idea there is, I think, kind of interesting of how can we avoid all the situations that are preventing someone from submitting an assignment? I think it's, to me, I'd like to approach it from a preventative standpoint, is that someone never actually needs to send that email because they've been able to either do work on it early or submit it early. This is something that I do in all of my classes, is work on assignments piece by piece over the course of the semester, because that feels the most protective, I guess. And so, I'd like to sort of explore that with students.
I really like that answer, Mitch. You got me thinking, maybe I should open up to that, because my approach to this has been, it's evolved, but if you're talking finals week, I'm like, you got till Friday at 5 p.m. That's it. Other than that, you can have an incomplete, because it's usually just one or two things. But throughout the semester, I offer everyone, I mean, I don't say it, but anyone who comes up and says, hey, I'm going to be a little late with whatever, I just say, okay, because I can only grade them one at a time. And there's always flex. And as long as I feel like I extend that to everybody, then that's fair. I don't want to encourage it. But I found creating conditions under which, I've watched other people do this. I did not do this. Get out your circular firing squad, a bingo card, because I'm going to reference my ADHD brain. I don't want to do something that's going to make more work for me, but I watch people, they try to have all of these circumstances under which you have to, if it meets these, then yes, you can be late. And then you go through all, you have to spend all this time deciding if it does. And then the student doesn't agree and you're back and you're forth. And I'm like, nah, just accept it. Do it with everybody. But finals week, yeah, Friday at 5 p.m., because I really want to get those grades turned in for a lot of reasons. I want to be done, but I want the students to get feedback as quick as possible.
I'm terrible at this. I'm glad that I don't have a lot of students that ask for it, because for me, it's difficult to decide whose excuse is better or worthy of an extension. I don't know what as you had mentioned, Mitch, that instructor who says, oh, you can hand it in early. I'm fine with people handing stuff in early, and some do. I'm not fine with having them hand it in early and me having to correct it and tell them what they should do so they could write it again and get a better grade. It seems like, as Elliot kind of referred to, more work for me. Work that is part of not on my, not on my playing field. Doing successive approximations to getting it right. A couple of times I did drafts and I got such lousy drafts that it was like, okay, now I know who's writing the paper here. And I wound up working harder than them, which I don't do with clients and I try to avoid doing with students. Occasional, I have a terrible migraine this weekend. Can I hand it in on Monday instead of Friday? Fine. I'm okay with that. And I don't necessarily publicize that to class. So I take it as individuals, but I don't have a lot of those in my spectrum. We had the discussion, I think, on a previous show about accepting some variance in terms of when people can hand it in instead of having a due date. And people fell on both sides of that. I don't have to deal with a lot of extensions on assignments. Maybe I scare the hell out of my students and they don't ask for it. But the few that I get, and I deal with them individually.
Marty, we just kind of outed ourselves, Next semester, everyone will be late.
Yeah. Well, it's
you got some inside information if you're listening to CFS, if you're in these classes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's too late to be late. My grades are due in 2 days. So, or Mitch, please give us the next question. And Mitch is frozen. Well, this is sort of a hard cut right here because Mitch was with us and about to deliver his second question and completely went black. You don't know this, but we've been sitting for about 10 minutes, Elliot and I, talking about stuff, hoping that he'll log in or that he'll message us or we'll get an email from him. And we haven't heard from him. So.
If you want the supplementary material, find us on Patreon.
Yeah. I don't know what happened, but apparently he can't contact at this moment. So we're going to go ahead and answer his question anyways. Here's Mitch's second question for the evening. What was your favorite arcade game growing up?
I love this question. I have a kind of two answers. One is playing straight Tron. Oh, I loved Tron. Didn't even see the movie. I thought it was stupid to make a movie out of it, but I just loved that game. Playing Stoned, it was the Star Wars game. The only time I went to Florida for spring break, it was like 60 degrees. It was horrible weather, and we just spent most of the time playing video games. But that one, we played the heck out of that one, so that was a good one.
Hey, yeah, I really wanted Mitch around for this because I needed to remind him. I grew up in the 60s. We didn't have arcade games when I was. He said, what was your favorite arcade game growing up? I'm like, I grew up in the 60s. The most we had was pinball games that were in bars or restaurants. And my, you know, I would go to restaurants with my family, never go to bars because we weren't drinkers. And then to ask your parents for a couple of quarters to play the pinball game, to them, in their generation, that's just throwing money away. So I didn't actually get into kind of arcade game until I was like in my mid-20s. And that was because Atari had come out with a game console that my intent in getting it was to write papers for my master's thesis and my master's program, because it had a cartridge and a slow tape recorder that would you could store it on. And it was a real rudimentary word processor. Well, along with that, I got a bunch of games and eventually kind of fell into, I'm terrible at games. Absolutely terrible. Don't put any money on me on games. I just don't get them. But Zaxxon, I did pretty well with Zaxxon, which is sort of a 16-bit kind of plane flying through a valley of guns and other attackers. And I got pretty good at that. But I wouldn't say by any means that was, I would have to default as my favorite, because I would get easily frustrated with games and go, you know, can't master this in the first couple of attempts or even get better. So yeah, I really wanted to berate Mitch about asking about arcade games like they've been around forever. But that's not the case.
So you didn't have a mall with an arcade? Like, I think this was probably early 70s, though.
Yeah. And, you know, by then I had such little money. I mean, you know, I didn't carry around a lot of cash when I was. And I certainly would rather have it in a soda or candy than put it into an arcade game that I would fail miserably anyways. So, yeah, just never had access to them and never had much interest in them.
It's funny because I have the only video games I've played, modern ones, are the Wii, which I love those. But I think especially before I had tenure, I always felt like every moment counted and I couldn't spend time learning like these video games. And then couldn't afford consoles. And so like the newer crop, I'm totally unfamiliar with other than Mario Kart or something like that. But boy, those big, my son and I, we had a bowling alley up in Stowe. They used to have a House of the Dead game, pristine. I was so sad when it finally broke, because they would repair it and we would spend probably, you know, $8, and we were pretty good at that, shooting zombies. But
Mitch is going to join us again. Here we go.
Hey, perfect timing.
Hey, Mitch.
Sorry about that.
We just answered your question.
Okay.
What was your favorite arcade game growing up? So we need to hear yours.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Let's just hop back into it. So my favorite arcade game was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, either the Turtles in Time version or the regular version. I don't know. There's a bunch of different versions out there, but I like games that you can play with four people at arcades. Sometimes it's fun to like stand around a cabinet and kind of like watch what everybody's doing, but I sort of like the team kind of like environment in arcades for some reason. And so like there's, you know, Cleveland's got an interesting scene with a couple really good arcade places or arcade bars. And typically, whenever there's a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I am hopping right on it.
You'll have to listen to the podcast to hear my answer to you, Mitch.
I'm going to, because you built it up a little bit. So I gotta hop back in and listen to it. Yeah.
So I'll patch this whole thing together and get it out in some format for listeners to be able to hear. I don't think it's going to be too difficult, but we're glad you're back in. Elliot, you've got the next question.
How do you feel about professors making endorsements, statements on political issues, generally outside their areas of expertise? And I ask this because I've had a lot of requests lately to sign petitions and letters, et cetera.
Well, I don't I think it's a bad idea. I really do. Especially if it's out of their area of expertise. I mean, if they're getting interviewed because the news wants an opinion piece or something that's in their area, I understand that. I have a tendency, because I've gotten those requests or they've funneled in my direction. Please, we need somebody to make an opinion about something you don't know anything about, but we got your name. Can you call us today at 5 o'clock and be able to give us by 5 o'clock and be able to give us your opinion on something you know nothing about? Because we have to finish this piece. I ignore them. Sorry, guys. I ignore them. The other thing is associations are being asked all the time to do this. And so you're seeing different types of professional associations coming out with statements and being asked to create statements by a small group of their members who are really passionate about something that really has very little impact on the professional counseling field. Or should I say the counseling field has very little impact on the political situation that they'd like us to make a statement in. And what happens is, if they do that, if the association makes a statement, then there's going to be another smaller group of people who don't agree with that statement, who are going to get pissed off and argue and create all sorts of drama around it. So it's a no-win situation. And so I wish people would kind of do their own filters and think, is this person or this association really credible on this issue? And maybe there are other places we can go to ask for statements that are meaningful regarding the political issue that is concerned. So it's a mess, because everybody is in the moment thinking, if we just shout loud enough, then change will happen. And we just need to get everybody to shout a lot. So sorry, I got political there.
So a spicy but welcome question. I have definitely thought about this before. Not that my professors are making a ton of endorsements or political statements, right? And I think, Dr. I, you're differentiating here between, right, the idea of, on one hand, just having an opinion versus a professional, right, like something that would be in something more professional, something more official, right? And so I have no issue with anyone having an opinion on anything. People can have opinions on whatever they want. It doesn't bother me. The idea of making an endorsement or a political statement about something that may not be in one's area of expertise is challenging, because I think what it does, or what it can do, is it can sort of dilute the individual's the perception of the individual and their area of expertise, right? Because I think that when someone does have an area of expertise, they're obviously very strong on it, and they are very knowledgeable, and they have opinions on it naturally. And the more that someone strays from sort of like their core professional identity, sometimes I think it can sort of muddy the waters of their core professional identity. And so I think that it's sort of cautionary in that if you are interested in making an endorsement and or making a political statement, it can be powerful. And at the same time, it can also present with some complications, right? I think, I don't have an issue if someone wants to go and do this. I'm not someone who particularly identifies with making a lot of right. It wouldn't identify with making an endorsement or a statement on something that I really didn't have any knowledge about. It doesn't seem, I have an opinion on it, but that doesn't mean that I want it to be officially used for some organization or for some other purpose than just like, oh, I just have some thoughts, and they're just thoughts and that's all they are.
I appreciate these answers, because I kind of figured this has happened several times, but with the whole situation between Hamas and Israel, and mm-hmm. this was going to come up, and it was a valued member of our part-time community and student community, and I didn't want to ghost the person, but I did want to give them what I thought, and I said it strikes me as contradictory, because it's like an overgeneralization. So I know a lot about whatever spirituality and psychotherapy, psychopharmacology, psychopathology, and I'm a professor at university. So you want to use that part, but then you want me to speak about something that I do know a bit about it, but you don't need me to speak as a professor. I can speak as a private citizen on that. And CSU certainly doesn't need me, you know, spouting not unformed, but half-formed political opinions. I had a very good friend through the Anglican Church who, he was an Arab-Israeli scholar, and he kind of tutored me over time on, it's like the complexity of the issue, issues that face them. But again, I kind of feel like it's kind of like when figure skaters win an Olympic medal, a lot of groups go after them immediately. And I'm like, why? You know, especially religious groups, they want them to like testify for the religion, or Disney. Disney loves these folks because of the squeaky clean image. I'm like, these people know skating. They get up every day at 3 a.m. and they've been figure skating most of their life. That's what they know. And now you want to basically co-opt that or prostitute that for your own goal. And I disagree with it. I think it's an abuse of the lectern, because then, you know, if something is related to Psycho Farm and I think it's corrupt and horrific, I say so. And I feel like, yeah, I can do that within the scope of my practice, but not in a way that threatens people to have the same opinion and doesn't allow them to develop their own opinions. But that's just within the area of expertise that I teach. And that's again, in the classroom, it's not public statements. I think I can just make those as a private citizen. And if you don't want me as a private citizen, then, you know, piss off. that's just the way I look at it.
I've got the next question. And when I thought of this question, I'm like, okay, how are we going to do this? Actually, I thought of the answer before the question. And then it's like, now how do I turn this into a question everybody can answer if they choose to do so? What's the weirdest illegal substance story that you have, either one that you participated in or one that you heard about from friends?
So part of me wants to hop on and give specifics to this question. And part of me wants to provide a more of a general type answer, because these stories are out there. These stories are out there on forums, and these stories are out there in people's posts and YouTube videos, and you know, people talk about them on podcasts. And I think that I've been interested in sort of like demystifying what like some of these substances, right? Like, because I think when you say like illegal substance story and weird, that could also be something that, you know, isn't in my kind of like realm, so to speak, of like psychedelic medicine, but is more along the lines of, you know, could be something like fentanyl, or it could be something like methamphetamine. And I think that some people, right, like they'll see a certain video, right? Like, I think we all remember, or we may remember, that video of that police officer who opened up the back of a trunk. There was fentanyl in the trunk. He's down on the ground and an officer saves his life. And it's like, wow, that's crazy. Like, I didn't even see the fentanyl. You know, like it's that dangerous, right? And so, but there's also, I think, these other experiences that people talk about like psychedelic experiences or whatnot. You can find this on, like, you know, you can find this on Reddit, you can find this on YouTube, you can find this all over, of people who are sharing some of their story, right? Because I think that some of the psychedelic stories that we share are sometimes more challenging to share, because I think that they are oftentimes so personal and they relate so personally to us that it's sometimes challenging to tell someone about a substance use story for like psychedelics without also providing a lot of the additional like personal background. And so I think what I would encourage people to do, if they are interested in this type of you know, people's stories, is there's a lot of communities online who have, you know, anonymous posts by people who are willing to share like what they've been through. And sometimes it's scary, and sometimes it's like, wow, that person did too much. Or sometimes it's like, wow, that person, you know, really, you know, was using that very safely and responsibly, and they seem to have a really profound experience. And so I do hope that the people out there, while I don't have I couldn't think of a specific story that didn't include someone who I knew, and I didn't think that, you know, I'd like for them to be able to share their story, right? But I think those stories are out there, and I do encourage people to read them because they are really fascinating.
It took me a while to figure out which one I wanted to share, but I've shared this on the podcast before, but I think it's been a couple of years. I was a co-presenter in graduate school And I knew a lot of psychonauts. I mean, that's I'm sure not going to surprise people. You know, a lot of people who like to take field trips to the frontal lobes, and I'm all for it. But we were doing a presentation. It was OCA, and it was we had a lot of pieces, parts to the presentation. We had it beautifully scripted. We had it all laid out. And then we're doing the presentation, and my co-presenter is like totally deviating from the script. And I'm like, whoa, okay. And he's like tuning into where people's facial expressions, he's tuning into what they're saying. He's making these intuitive leaps that seem therapeutically brilliant to me in the moment. And we're at about the last 5 minutes doing Q&A, and it dawns on me, this mother trucker took ecstasy before our presentation. And that's, you know, that's the other good side of learning about substances and their behavioral effects. Cause I'm like, I recognize this. This is, and it was like, that was what happened. And it was the presentation was rated quite highly, and I could only applaud his affective intuition. And so it threw me, but it was a weird experience that I deeply appreciate.
I want to correct that story factually. What I took was MMDA, not ecstasy. No, I'm not the person Elliot's talking about. Mitch, you did this with such a heartfelt, personal experience. And I'm like, no, that's not what the question was for me. The question was, what was my weirdest experience? And my sister listens to this podcast, and maybe she should just skip over this part. High school graduation, or about a week before, my parents are out of the house, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to play minor chemistry major, and I'm going to try and do extraction from weed. And so I had stuff cooking on our kitchen stove, and then I hear my mother open the front door, and the stuff I'm cooking, I mean, I guess you could tell it was something weird, but I didn't know what to do. So I ran into the pantry before she could come through the length of our house, and I got some blue dye, blue food coloring, and poured it into what I was cooking up, trying to extract and reduce into it. And she came into the kitchen and she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm just doing this thing for chemistry." And it didn't look like weed anymore. It was just this blue dyed gunk. So I wasn't going to throw it out. So I got some wax paper and poured it out on wax paper like I was making peanut brittle, and let it dry. And it dried, and I had these blue flakes. So come graduation night, I'm second in line or third in line, because I, despite my high school, I did really well there. And we're out cruising around smoking what we called was the blue flakes, having a great time. So whatever it was that I did, it worked, at least for that evening. And we almost didn't make it to graduation in time. We're literally running down this long hallway to get to the front of the line in our gowns that aren't tied up and everything like that. And just within a minute, we made it there and graduated, and remember very little of it, which was okay.
So the studio audience can't see I am busting a gut, because that is a comedic series of events.
Smoking the blue flakes, man.
And of course, yeah, of course you wouldn't let it go. I was like, yep.
I don't know if my parents were too kind, too afraid, or too innocent to know what I was up to, but that was never brought up, you know, me attempting to hide that illegal substance that way. So that's my story. Final shot question. What's the worst Mother's Day present?
So I think it's probably going to depend, right, for each individual person on their mom. And so I took this question personally, like, what's the worst Mother's Day present that I could get from my mom? Nothing. And I have forgotten some holidays before in my life. So I can assure you that has been the worst. Maybe not for her, but for me, yes.
For my dear sainted mother, her son getting in trouble. That I did it on her birthday once. Thought I'd get away with it. It was not intentional, but yeah. So me staying out of trouble after that, any holiday was good as long as I stayed out of trouble.
You know, I kind of took this as, let's come up with, and I shared it. My sister was in town today and coming visiting for my son's graduation. And I said, I came up with this final shot question. What do you think? And she said, you know, I had a friend who gave her mother a vacuum cleaner for Mother's Day. And I thought, oh, I'm going to use that. So That is my worst Mother's Day gift, would be to give your mother a vacuum cleaner. But Mitch, you reminded me, when I was a junior in college, I had moved into a basement apartment where my father said to me, now don't turn this into a dope pit and a sex den. And of course it turned into a dope pit and sex den. But I'm exaggerating there. Anyway, Sunday night, I get a phone call from my father, and he's like, my father never initiated the calls. He's like, I said, what's going on? He goes, it's Mother's Day and you haven't called your mother. I say, oh, and that was the worst it got. I mean, that is worse he got about it. And the amount of shit. So not calling, I think, would be the worst Mother's Day gift that you could come up with. Maybe you have either given worst Mother's Day gifts or received worst Mother's Day gifts, but that's what this panel of Y chromosomes have come up with. So look for some of these characters on their podcasts on the podtalk.net. You can find out more about them at circularfiringsquad.net. Make sure and check out the Tech Savvy Professor podcast hosted by Eric and myself. And I've started a new podcast with another Eric that is a weekly podcast on the Apple Vision Pro device. There are very few podcasts around it. It's called Vision Profiles is the podcast name, and you can find out about it at visionprofiles.info. That's it for this episode of Circular Firing Squad. Ready, fire, aim.